Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to BOLLandBranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sheila Shoiga, and this is Ready to Be Real Conversations, the podcast series where I chat to people of all walks of life. Some names you'll recognise, others you might not, but my hope is that these conversations will at times inspire, challenge, educate, comfort, or simply entertain you. This week, I catch up with comedian and radio presenter PJ Gallagher.
So I went back to the doctor and he goes, OK, well, what's happening? And we sat down and he goes, right, you're feeling a little bit too excited, and he has, like, they have a checklist, you know, they go through a whole session. It's like, are you spending a lot of money? Are you taking risks you would never normally take? And it was like, no. And he goes, well, yeah, no, you're just happy, like, you've just forgotten what it's like, it's just been a while. Wow. He's like, there's nothing wrong with you feeling this good, like, this is not erratic happiness or dangerous happiness, you're just in a good place, just happy.
And did it freak you out, like, the feeling?
No, I thought it was very funny. Remember thinking, I can't believe, like, I remember sitting, like, laughing. I was saying, I can't believe I thought, like, I'm enjoying my life so much, I thought I was sick again.
Yeah, okay.
You know, I was, like, worried about being, I was worried about being happy, you know. I couldn't believe that. That was, like, what?
Yeah.
That was mad. But it was such a nice, secure feeling,
and
it makes you want to hold on to it then, you know, it becomes a valuable thing then.
PJ lives in Clontarf in Dublin with his partner Kelly and their 12-week-old twins, Milo and Stevie. He presents The Breakfast Show on Nova with his friend Jim McCabe. He's also currently working on a documentary for RTE and his book Madhouse, The Naked Truth About My Chaotic Childhood. Losing My Mind and Finding a Place to Call Home is out now and it's a brilliant read. We spoke back in the summer of 2021 and it was a chat that really resonated with listeners. So this conversation picks up where we left off the last time. He speaks about his 3 month stay in St. Patrick's mental health services, meeting his now partner Kelly, fatherhood, polyamory, and knowing what works for his mental well-being. Here it is.
I do remember the chat, and I got so much feedback from it. Oh my God, like, I had so much feedback from that last podcast that we did. Yeah. So it seemed to have, I got a lot of messages from people on Instagram and stuff, you know.
People love you. They do. And I think what, you know, being so honest really touched people as well. But I think a lot of people felt like I did. God, you know, he's really hard on himself. Like,
well, I guess maybe that's something I haven't learned a lot about. I don't know. That's a hard one to put my finger on.
I know.
People have said that to me loads and I've never really kind of agreed with it in a way, if you know what I mean.
So, yeah, right.
It's one of those things. Like, I think you kind of have an idea of who you are or where you stand and that probably doesn't change. But how you feel about that is kind of what's important, you know.
Yeah.
You know, if you feel like, oh, maybe, you know, I'm kind of getting away with it. That's all right. You'll always feel like that. But then you kind of think, well, that's great, isn't it? You know, I'm getting away with it. You know, there's a bit of that, maybe.
Yeah,
it's probably an attitude change more than
Yeah.
An idea change. I don't know if that makes any sense.
No, it does. It does. Yeah. I remember at the time you were saying you weren't a fan of hugs. So we were still in the kind of...
That hasn't changed.
That hasn't changed.
No. I think, and now I remember we were talking about anti-social distancing, I think. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, no, that hasn't changed. No.
Don't touch it.
I still don't understand why you have to touch someone to say hello. arms reach is a thing for a reason. You put your hand out, stay over there. Thank you. Shake hands. Grand. You're all right. Stay where you stand. There's no need for us to start wrestling, you know.
So life at the moment is, I can't imagine actually how busy it is because you are now dad to twins.
Yeah, but as I speak to you at the moment, it's not that busy because they're gone. So my partner's from Boston.
Yeah.
So they're all in Boston and I won't see them again until Christmas. So it's actually gone the other way. It's gone from having 12 weeks of complete and utter craziness and madness and trying to get your head around these two babies. Well, one baby. One of them's really easy. One baby. One insane baby.
So it's a boy and a girl.
Yeah.
Milo and Stevie.
Milo and Stevie, yeah. Milo's the boy. I didn't really think I'd have to explain that when we were naming them, but here we are.
I wouldn't have thought you've had to explain that either. Milo is, am I right in thinking that Milo is the busy one?
Yeah, he's mental.
Is he?
Yeah. Like he's absolutely... It's unbelievable.
They're very different.
Yeah, but it's like you look after Stevie and, you know, Stevie kind of, in a way, kind of looks after you. She doesn't moan. She's like, she cries when she's hungry or when she wants something. Most of the time, it's kind of laid back. It's easy going, whatever. And then it's just like lion taming. Like, it's unbelievable. He's just waiting to turn on you all the time. Like, that's what I was saying to someone recently, that you get what you put into the world, you know. Like, Stevie's like her ma. They're only 12 weeks old, but she's like, you know, predictable and doesn't make a big deal of things and seems to just get on with life and, you know, knows what's going on around, knows the surroundings. And he's like me. It's just like drama, chaos, unnecessary upset, like constant chaos. So, yeah, you get what you wear, I think, you know. But they're great. Like, they are brilliant. It's just, but it's not easy. My God, it's not easy. Especially when you're an elephant. Like, that is the thing.
Well, what are you, 48?
48. So it's funny. I meet people and they go, oh, no, I had kids late too. I was 39. I'm like, I'm so much further up the road. Or I had my baby when I was 45. Someone told me. I'm like, yeah, I had two at 48. So let's not play the comparison game. Let's not pretend I'm not too, like, I'm not getting on. Like, because I am getting on for this, you know. But that's all right. Like, it's okay that that's the case. But my God, you know,
when
I worked out that I'll get my bus pass before they'll have their first legal point, I was like, right, that's not normal.
Well,
that's
look,
okay.
Well, I wonder, nowadays, I suppose we are. Like, I was a late bloomer as well. And, do you know, like, I had my first... A 38, second of 42.
You just did what I said. You just
did
what I said.
I just did it.
Yeah, I'm 38. That was 10 years ago. I have a 10-year-old now.
Okay.
No, yeah, I know. It's different for women, though, in fairness.
I get the point.
It's different for women because you're up against biology and all that.
No, and I also had an individual human at a time. You're having two of them.
Yeah, maybe that's easier in a way. Maybe it's easier in a way.
That's all you know, I suppose.
Yeah, that's all I know. But I thought my only other example is my friend Stephanie, you know, and she's like about to go into her second at the moment.
Yeah.
And like all she can think of is how hard it was and how she has to do it again. And I'll never have to do that. You know, like it's just really intensely
tough.
Why?
You're done.
Oh, yeah, sure. I got the rifle decommissioned 2 weeks after they were born. Yeah.
Did you?
Oh, I did, yeah. Oh, my. Immediately I knew. Like, immediately. I was like, this is amazing, but we're never doing it again. And I went into the doctor and, like, for the vasectomy, you know.
Yeah.
And just around the corner here, and I went in and he goes, okay, have you spoken to your partner? Because your partner's younger than you are. Kelly is like, you know, Kelly's younger than me, you know.
Yeah.
I was there, yeah. And she would like literally have us remove the entire equipment. All the apparatus could come off and it would be fine. So there's no question that this is the right thing to do. There's no question, you know. And he's like, oh yeah, because it's, you know, it's very tough to reverse. And there's no reversal. We both knew. Like, this is it. And Kelly had a rough time with the birds. And, oh no, it's great. Like, everything's fine now. But it was a rough run. And she's still having a rough run. She's on her, you know, she's still...
recovering.
She's mammying now. And I'm over here, you know, just getting on with stuff until I can join them again.
Yeah. So, so you'll spend Christmas in Boston?
Yeah, I'm going to go to Boston for Christmas, yeah.
Nice.
Nice, yeah. It
so
is
her
nice.
Family will be a support, I suppose, and a help.
Yeah, so that's the whole idea. I'm at the moment, I'm doing 12-hour days, 14-hour days.
Yeah.
And on the run to Christmas, because there's so much going on. So too much,
just,
really.
It's not just the book promo. You've other stuff as well.
Yeah, we're making a documentary on mental illness now for RTE.
Good on you.
And I'm doing the radio show every morning. There's an awful lot. I'm trying to write an animation thing and everything has to be finished before Christmas.
Yeah, okay.
So it's just too much. And yeah, we had to think of something, and we've no family here.
Yeah,
so.
Sure. And you're the type of person, I would imagine, you're really helpful and accommodating. Like, okay, so I came in here this morning for this chat and I have a puncture. And straight away, you didn't even miss a beat. You're like, I'll help you with that. Do you have a spare in the boot? I'll sort it for you after the chat.
Yeah, but
that's the kind of guy you are. You know, you'll help people and you'll want to, if somebody asks you to do something, you'll want to do it. I'd say, do you kind of not want to kind of say no to people? So with the way you're saying now, well, you've so much going on, is it because you're kind of saying yes to a lot of stuff?
Saying yes to a lot of stuff, probably too much in fairness. Right. And yeah. Timing caught me out. I think I remember saying to you before that I've learned to say no to things and I've gotten caught out now again.
Okay.
Whereas before I would have been in an awful state because I would have thought, just one more day, just get through this and like then it'll be fine, or just keep your head down or keep going, no matter what, keep going. You know, it would have been a weird sort of toxic drive. Mm. Now it's like I have a finish line, and then when I hit that finish line, I'm going to do nothing for anyone. And that's kind of important. I think that's how a new thing. So when I go to the States, the phone will be off. I won't talk to anyone.
Good.
It'll be 10 days of just complete quiet. And then when I come home, I have no intention of getting back to this level of intensity of work.
Yeah. The radio show.
Yeah, I'll go back to the radio show and probably try and do that, and I'll write one other thing and nothing else.
Okay, good.
So yeah, because I know how easily I can be overwhelmed. And like you said, out of panic, I will say yes to anything. So, and the thoughts of getting cash and money and looking after babies now, and like everything's, it's unbelievable how expensive they are. Jeez, I thought bikes were expensive. Like babies are, like everything, and it's all on the double. And
yeah,
you know, like that's the thing as well. Like even if we got a night nurse for a couple of nights, and we were like, for two, it's big money just to sit in your own bed, you know.
Yeah.
So it's hard to justify all these things. And then I panic. I have to make money. I have to do this. I'm agreeing to things I wouldn't want to do. And so.
No, I get you, because I was, I suppose, quite laid back in terms of work and stuff I do. And then I became a parent, and I went like, you know, that drive to, oh no, say yes to the work because, you know, you need the money.
Yeah, yeah.
It shifts something in you as well. I do think that becoming a mother or father does kind of do something to you massively inside in terms of it changing your wiring.
Yeah, and I think as a fella as well, like, you kind of feel when the kids are born, you're a little bit on the outside. You know, you can try and help and get as involved as you can, but you're always kind of despair. At the moment, I'm kind of despair. So Kelly's just very good at certain things when it comes like this, and I'm not, and I'm trying, and then I realise I can be in the way and annoying, and then you think, well, I'm going to make up for it this way. So you sort of go, well, I'm just going to work my arse off to try and make everything okay in a different way.
Yeah.
And you can get carried away with it. And I did get carried away with it. And that's more panic than anything else, and trying to contribute and getting it wrong and not communicating. That's the thing as well. So getting there, you know.
Yeah.
You keep talking, you know. So I think we're going to go to a couples therapy actually just to try and get in front of problems, because everything's kind of going okay now.
Okay, that's good.
But we've had some moments, you know, where you sort of bicker. And I've never bickered before. It's never been my thing, you know. So we're just like, okay, this is like, we're obviously still really into each other. This is going really well as a relationship. It's just hard. It's two of us and two kids, no one else. So let's just like make sure we're communicating properly. So when we come back, like that's sort of mission number one is just like get a referee, you know.
Yeah, that's
someone
great,
that can blow
PJ.
A whistle and go, foul, yellow card, PJ out, you know. So it's like, I think I've got to start doing that.
But no, but for both of you, that's great, because as you said, you're kind of getting ahead before maybe it gets to a place, because obviously, you know, having kids puts huge pressure on a relationship.
Yeah, and I know what it's like to think things are going to be grand when they're not. So
yeah, and you've also said before that you're kind of modus operandi when it came to kind of difficulty in relationships was to just leg it.
Leg it, yeah, run for the hills, yeah.
And I suppose want to do that necessarily.
I don't want to do that. Yeah,
so
exactly.
Maybe avoid the running bit.
It's a bit more at stake now.
Yeah.
So it's more about protecting something than running away from something, you know.
So what about the birth? So it was that a kind of a chaotic time when they came into the world?
Oh, yeah. It was mostly Kelly's situation in the hospital that was hard, to be honest. Kelly was like, you know, she was determined. Kelly's American, so she thinks she can do everything. And that means 99% of the time she actually probably can.
Yeah.
So she thinks everything's going to be all right. And I'm the opposite. I think everything's going to go terrible. So anything after that is a bonus.
Yeah.
And she went into the hospital and everything was going fine. And then we had all kinds of complications and we didn't realise just small things like about, you know, how you, when you have twins, your water breaks twice and we're getting caught, just small little things. And
yeah.
And then she started to have like, she needed a couple of blood transfusions because she was losing a lot of blood after the kids were born. She was a whole week in the hospital and one of the kids was in the incubator and the other one wasn't. So she only had time with one and we were separated then because I was spending most of my time trying to feed him while she was in the room downstairs, kind of tied to a bed with, you know, cables and all that when she couldn't go. So it was really tough. That first
Very
week was
tough.
Really,
God.
Really tough.
Yeah.
And then we came home and it was a weird divide nearly, you know, because she'd spent so much time looking after Stevie. I'd spent so much time looking after Milo. And then it was kind of like, do we even know the other babies? It was really tough. It was really, really tough. And then you're just not going to bed. You know, you're wearing the same pair of trousers for 3 days.
Yeah.
You haven't even taken them off. Like, you know, so you're just like this revolving door. And Kelly, because she's American, is like, no, you need to sleep. You got the radio show. I'm like, Jesus, right. Okay. I'm not going to not go to bed. But more difficult.
Yeah.
So, yeah, but we're getting there. And then, like, just this morning, they missed one feed at night. So they're just making life a little bit easier now. You know, one feed has dropped today. And it's like reason to celebrate because at least you can sleep a little bit. And yeah, so I don't know. I don't know how she does it. Like, she's just
you're in the
warrior.
Trenches. I mean,
she's in the trenches. Like,
yeah, but I have no idea what it's like to have twins. None. But I can only begin to imagine, like, it's as you said, it's doubling up on everything. But it is like you, the newborn stage, as much as there are beautiful moments and there are, but it's Jesus, there are times when it's so bloody hard.
Yeah, you're just waiting for them to, you know.
Yeah.
Just the joys that you look
forward
to.
Exhaustion.
Just when they can hold a bottle themselves.
Yeah.
It's going to be such a big day, you know.
Yeah.
Or
yeah, it is.
Not even hold a bottle, just stick something in your mouth, you know. A nugget. Imagine the celebration. You'll never be more celebrated chicken nugget in the world than the time they hold one and feed it themselves. Be like, oh my God, that's like literally 8 hours a day saved. Because you can put a nugget in your own mouth, you know, it'll be the most celebrated nugget, the most celebrated piece of carrot, the most, you know, all these things you look forward to, you never thought you would. So, yeah, you're looking forward to a chicken nugget you'll never get to eat, you know.
Oh, I was going to ask you a bit more about Kelly, but I think what I'll do at this point is kind of go back to where we were. So anyway, we were chatting in summer 21. And then, as you said, a few months later, things just started to really kind of close in on you and you were in bad shape.
Yeah, around August. Yeah, it was around August. I think it's really hard to remember the timeline because when you're not well, the first thing you can do is you lose track of perspective of time even, you know. I think that's one of the reasons they say you should keep a diary when you start to get ill is so you can look back and because you think, I felt like this forever. But if you look back on a diary, you might see it's been a week rather than 2 months or whatever. But I just started feeling, I knew I was in trouble, but I'd been there before. I just never said it to anyone before. I never talked about it. I just had my own way of dealing with it. So I knew I would get into trouble, feel that I wasn't well, go to see a doctor, get medication, go on the medication. When I feel better, I'd come off it and then I'd just carry on with my life. And that was kind of my way.
Yeah.
Never really quite understood why that is completely the worst thing in the world to do and why it's so ill-advised and why you should never do it, just because it worked for me. So, as most people do, you think your anecdotal evidence is the real thing.
Mm.
And then I started to get sick again, something I was kind of used to. Went, got the medication, except this time it wasn't getting better and it was getting worse. And I started to think then I started thinking about bracing myself just for making fake moments in time. In 6 months, it'll be fine. You know, literally plucking these out of my arse. Like, these are non-existent time. Just making up a timeline. If I can just get to this point, everything began. As if that ever happens in life where you have a line in the sand and you cross it and there's suddenly nothing else to do. That's just not life, you know. So it sort of came to the point where I was thinking, if I can get to the end of the month, I'll start to feel better. And then it was, if I can get to the end of the week, if I can get to the end of the day, if I can get to the end of this hour. And literally then I got to the point where I couldn't go moment to moment. Like, you know, it just felt like torture. Like, I just started to live in this hell, this complete and utter just circular thoughts of how useless you are, how pointless you are, how the world is better off without you in it, how you're just a drain, how you're always in the way, you're just taking up space, you have no right to be here, everything you've ever done is bullshit. Like, you're going to be destitute, you're not going to be able to feed yourself because you're not really good at what you do, you're fucking, like, just this over and over again. And then the only way I could get away from that cycle of thought was to start thinking about harming myself or just not being around anymore. And then that becomes obsessive because that's kind of the only way you can feel in any way better, which is hard to get my head around now, but I do remember being in that mindset completely. And then you become obsessed with it. All you want to do is just not be around. And I was walking through Phoenix Park one day, literally fell to my knees. I just couldn't take it anymore. And was, I mean, at this point, I was already talking to Aisling, I was already talking to Elaine, I was talking to Pete, people who were very, very close to me, but nobody else. And it was so obvious in work there was something wrong with me. Like, people were saying it in work, like, what's wrong with, like, there's something wrong with him. And I was still just hiding it. I said it to Jim then, when I felt I had to, Jim, who I work with in Radio Nova, like.
Yeah.
And nobody else knew. And then I became obsessed with the cover-up. You know, just no one can know. So even though all this was going on, I was still more worried about people finding out than I was of actually being dead. In fact, being dead was a kind of a good thing to me, and people knowing was the bad thing. So that'll tell you how sickness lies to you.
And was it the shame of it?
It was the shame of it, yeah. Absolute shame. And people thinking that you were kind of, like, I guess it was also the feeling of being found out as well, because I thought the sickness was confirmation of all these negative thoughts, you know? Mm. So at least I could die in the lie that it's not true, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And those things were becoming important to me because being alive wasn't important to me. And that's like, that was, I guess that was the point when I started to, through this whole period, by the way, I was going into the psychiatrist a lot, like talking to him every few days, and they were giving me sedatives, not to make me feel better, but just to try and take the weight out of these thoughts. They were giving me sedatives, so I was on a lot of sedatives, and I was trying out new medications, and they just weren't having any impact. Things were just not getting better. And then and they were saying, you have to go to hospital. Like, everyone at this point was saying, you really need to go to hospital. Stephanie Prison was saying it to me. Like, Ashley was saying it, Elaine was saying it to me. The doctors were saying it to me. So everyone that knew was saying to me, you have to go to hospital. And I was fighting it. But it was just that when it was that worst, it was like, I will go.
Yeah.
And then I thought you could just walk in, but you can't. Mm. It still took another 3 weeks to get in the door. And I know now I never had to get to that point of sickness. I know that now, but in my head at the time, I mean, depression's so articulate. It's such a brilliant liar. It's like, yeah. Depression's an incredible liar. Like, depression is Hitler. Like, it's a great orator that sits on your shoulder and tries to make you believe shit. But it's such an articulate liar, and it's so practiced. It's going all day long, like all day long. So when you try to argue against it with anything that's common sense, it just feels stupid. It doesn't feel true. You can argue against yourself so easy. But it is like if someone who is the best talker, best speaker you know, was sitting in front of you all day telling you were a piece of shit, you still wouldn't listen to it. But when you're doing it to yourself, you will.
Yeah. Whoa. And I know you've mentioned Elaine, you were married to Elaine.
Yeah.
So she's your ex. Aisling is an ex as well.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm still married to Elaine. We're in the process of getting a divorce, but we're getting on.
It takes a while, doesn't it?
Yeah, it takes a while. But she's great, you know, she's brilliant. And Aisling's brilliant as well.
And she's an ex as well.
Yeah, yeah. So like we've been, I know. Relationships have been tough.
Isn't it great that you have these friendships
You know? It is, I'm lucky that I've always had good people in my life regardless.
I know that Stephanie is a great pal and really there for you, and I know you've spoken about her as well. But if you don't want to go there, because it's perhaps something that you don't want to talk about, but just in terms of how dark it got, because it does sound like, you know, the thoughts were all consuming.
Yeah, yeah.
In terms of the self-harming or the not wanting to be here anymore, did they go more from a thought to an action?
Well, I was to the point where I mean, it's kind of, it's degenerative. In my particular case, it was degenerative. So it wasn't enough to just think about it or fantasize about it. Then to, you know, when that became a tired thought, it developed into, well, how would you do it? And then you choose to yourself, and then you think, well, this is how I do it. And then you start fantasizing about doing that. And it's like a tape going on and off, or it's like literally watching a YouTube video, just stopping and starting over and over and over again in your head, where you've decided how it would go and what you would do and how it would work. And I did come down to one day where I woke up and thought, today's the day. Like, I'm not going to get to the end of today. I do remember that feeling. I do remember that really very, very clearly. I remember it. And I had a message on my phone from Stephanie Preisner saying, I've talked to her about this, or actually about this really recently. We both remember it slightly differently, but what one thing we can both agree on is that she was always like, I'll never tell you what to do, but just if you ever think about doing something, just tell me if you are. And I had a message saying, no time is too late or early. You can call me anytime. And I called her. And I do believe that moment saved my life. I really do believe that was a life-saving moment for me.
Yeah. What a great pal.
Yeah, she's amazing. I can't speak highly enough about her. I get emotional thinking about not just that, but everything she's done for me. Jesus, I mean, so one-sided as a friendship. But she's like been amazing, you know. And she basically came to the rescue. I mean, genuinely. Now, that doesn't mean something would have happened in that moment, but I don't think I'd have made it through that day or the next couple of days. I really don't, had I not had that conversation with her. And I remember sitting in the car with her, just rocking backwards and forwards, like literally, like, you know, to see tortured animals in the, like that. And her just saying, your needs are met. You know, no, it doesn't feel like that, but right now all your needs are actually met. And that was an echo, you know, and that was kind of when it was, okay, I'm definitely going to hospital, but I had to hold on like white knuckle tight for another few weeks until we went in, which is the best thing I've ever done. Should have gone in months before, but it was the best thing I'd ever done because it was Christmas. It was like, I think 10 days before Christmas or something when I went in. When I think about it now, we're walking in there in the Christmas tree and everyone's sitting around and, you know, playing games and the whole lot. And it winds down, you know, the hospital winds down a bit.
Okay, yeah.
You know, people are taking time off and the doctors aren't around as frequently as they would be. So it was very, very quiet when I went in. You know, a lot of people went home for Christmas and it was during COVID too. So everything was pulled back as well. It was so surreal. Like the whole thing was just so surreal. But if you had told me that day that in 4 weeks' time, I'd be feeling like a brand new person and not want to leave the place. That's what I didn't want to leave. After 8 weeks, you were telling me I wanted to go home. I was like, I don't want to go home.
Yeah, So when you walked in, was it kind of what was going through your head?
Well, I went in to my boss. In my head, I thought, as soon as you come out about this, you've lost everything anyway. So you've lost your job. Number one, your job is gone. That was primary thought in my head.
Right.
Was, as soon as I tell my boss this, my job is gone. So I just had to accept that my career was over. That's what my head said. I went into Kevin in Nova and I said to him, like, I have to go to the hospital. And he didn't even ask me why. He just said, whatever you need, we're with you. That's it. That's all he said. Whatever you need.
It's great.
That's all he said. Whatever you need. I'll never forget it. Your place is safe. Don't worry about it. Whatever you need. I'll never forget that moment.
That's really cool.
And even then, the shithead in me was thinking, yeah, as soon as I'm out of here, you know, whatever. But that was it.
Because that's just the way you're wired.
That was just how I was wired, you know. That's the unwell, sick mentality, you know.
Yeah.
And I still thought it was gone. I thought they'll find a way to get rid of me one way or another. So I was sure of that. And I remember saying to him, 3 weeks, 4 weeks tops. That's what I said. I'll be back in 4 weeks. There's no doubt about it. And weirdly, when they said they'd take me into the hospital, the first thing, as bad as I was, I remember thinking, I'm not sick enough to be in here. So in my head, I thought it was like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. I thought it was an asylum was what was in my head. So I said 4 weeks and he was like, no, whatever, no problem. Like, we got your back and you're fine and the whole lot. So that was a huge relief. I couldn't believe his reaction. Like, I couldn't believe his reaction. And went into the hospital and, I mean, I went in, I did my COVID test because it was like that at the time. And you weren't allowed to leave this little room until the test came back negative. And that took hours. Like, that was hours sitting there. And there was a young woman sitting opposite me who I came to be quite friendly with. And she was the same. We never said hello to each other. We never talked to each other. There was a TV on the background with no sound. Just sitting there listening to music and nothing going on. No one really came in or out. They gave us a sandwich each. And I remember she opened it up and looked inside the old seat and just didn't eat it. And I was like, what is this place? What is going to happen when I leave this room? 5 hours or something I was in there. And then we went upstairs to the ward and walked past everyone. And one woman came up and gave me a set of rosary beads, which that did kind of freak me out. But that was the only weird experience. It just had to happen that day, didn't it?
Yeah,
and then
another
woman came up and says, listen, what do you want? I thought you worked there. And she was like, I'll show you around. Like, what do you want to see? I'll show you how the place works and whatever else. And we're really good mates. I was up with her yesterday, actually, in Cavan.
All right, okay.
And we're really good mates now. And she just took me under her wing, kind of, as a hospital mate, you know.
Yeah.
Like you'd imagine in prison, you know, except in prison, you have to be really wary of the person that comes to help over. In St. Pat's, you can really just trust this person means well for me.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then I didn't realise that within a couple of weeks, I'd be booking, going out on walks, using the garden. I mean, ordering food in, you know, getting me Camille on a Friday night, watching TV, watching football, how normal it would be.
Yeah.
I just didn't realise it was just going to be a retreat. I just didn't get that.
Okay. And this is why actually you talking about it is really good, because, you know, while not everybody listening will know someone in St. Pat's, I do. And like you, had this preconception of what it was and ended up being the best thing he ever did for himself. And, you know, I think that's a really important message to get out there that, you know, I know shame was a big barrier for you, but actually there is no shame in it. And it's so...
There really shouldn't be.
No.
And definitely not in there. I mean, everyone in there is in the same boat. Like, everybody in there. And that's... I had in my head as well, you'd walk in and you wouldn't know who you'd be around. You know, I thought there'd be... I don't know what I was thinking. Criminals and all. And I'd be sitting down eating my dinner and upsetting people who have eating disorders. Or I'd be, you know, talking about drinking and then sending an alcoholic off the deep end. Like crazy stuff.
Right.
But, you know, you're in wards with people who are similar to you. So everyone in my ward was more or less kind of anxiety, depression, OCD. And people who have... There's a ward for people who have eating disorders. They get their special treatment. There's the ward that treats addiction more specializes in addiction than ward for that just women are on. There's one where the more older people are on. Like, it's organized and such. And then you're all coming together anyway.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
No one's getting upset because you're sick. Everyone's trying to support you is what I'm trying to say, I guess.
Mm. Were you given a definition as to, like, depression? Is that what you were told?
Yeah, recurrent depressive disorder, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, mixed with an anxiety disorder. What a great couple of mates they are. I mean, I think I say it in the book. They're just like Peter Gabriel and Kate Bush, you know. They're so good at dancing together.
Yeah,
like they
torture,
you know. One tells you that staying in bed all day is the best thing to do. And the other one says the longer you stay in bed, the worse things are going to get. And you never know what one to listen to. And they drive you stir crazy. They dance you into the grave sometimes. It's they're great bedfellows, you know. Torture. It's just about torturing yourself, really.
Yeah. So the recurrent bit is the bit, I suppose, that you need to be aware of, I suppose, that it can kind of come in waves.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it'll come again. There's no doubt about it. It has come through the history of my life, I guess, plenty of times. It's always just been manageable before. You know, I was able to get in front of it. But I still wasn't treating it right.
Yeah.
So next time it comes, it's going to be fine.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's the thing.
So you have the tools now, is that
it? I have the tools now. I know what meds to take. I have a surplus supply of, I know what to do in my condition when that happens. I know the psychologist I am to talk to. I know the psychiatrist I need to talk to. I have people at the end of the phone. I'm not afraid to tell anyone in my life the story, the situation. I know I can approach my boss in work. I mean,
that's great, PJ.
So what was 6, 7, 8 months, a year of absolute hell and torture is going to be a few weeks of feeling not great. And that's the thing. I'm totally in control of that now.
It doesn't seem like it scares you now.
It doesn't scare me at all. I'm in charge now. You know, I'm in charge. No matter what happens now, I'm in charge of it. Mm. It won't scare me in the same way you have your first panic attack. You think the world's going to end. And then eventually they come. You learn how to deal with it. You remind yourself it's not forever. And, you know, It's hard to do. It's not never going to be easy to deal with. But I know I'll be able to take. I know how to get in front of it now.
Yeah.
And that's what's important, you know.
Yeah, big time. So in front of your boss, you were saying like, you know, 3-4 weeks tops, I'll be back. Obviously, it was longer than that.
Yeah, it was 3 months. Yeah.
Yeah.
12 weeks off work. Like, yeah. And it could have been more because they wanted me not to go back to work when I did. They recommend that you take X amount of time to bring yourself back into the world, I suppose.
Because I suppose going back into your home environment and your, you know, air quotes, real life can kind of...
Scares the shit out of you. Scares the shit out of me.
And it can bring you back to where you were maybe before you went in. Yeah, is that
a fear? And it does happen. Some people do go out and have to go straight back in.
Mm.
But that's fine as well. I think that's fine as well. When you leave, there's a home care package. So they keep your bed empty for you.
Very good.
And they're still ringing you every single day and they're checking in on you and they're still paying for your medication and they're still doing all that sort of stuff. So that's happening all the time. And they would obviously prefer you didn't just jump in the deep end when that's happening. But that's, you know, so, and some people go out and they go, whoa, I'm not ready. And they just go straight back in. It's fine. It's all a part of it. It just didn't happen with me. I was able to stay out. And again, the only thing is, the only negative, I think, in all of it is that you have to be kind of privileged to be able to access those
facilities. Yeah.
That's the real negative.
So is it health insurance?
Health insurance, yeah. So whatever happens now, so I have to make sure I have like $4,000 a year, basically, to make sure I stay out of trouble. And that's an awful lot of money. And I think most people don't have that kind of money. Mm. And now I worry about that kind of money when there's kids coming in, you know, and that's where the trap is. You know, having to find, making sure you can find a way to look after yourself first, because depression, if it gets in, is going to tell me they're better off without me. Whereas now that I'm well, I know they need me. So it's kind of keeping that balance. So I have to make sure I budget for that.
Sure.
But I don't know what I'd do without it. I don't know what a lot of people could do without it. And it is, that's a big problem. Like, that's a huge, huge problem.
Mm.
It's hard enough going in there when you can access it.
Yeah.
So when you can't, it's a thing, you know, it's a big, so it is a privilege to be able to reach out and, you know, get that help. It really is, you know, that's why I'm trying to talk to a lot of lads. I get contacted mostly by, it's funny, mostly by men online and mostly by women on the street. For some reason, I don't know what the separation there is.
Maybe men are more comfortable kind of the anonymity of online, perhaps.
Maybe. I've been doing a lot of talks on it and in workplaces and stuff. And when it's a man, no one says anything. And then you go home and there'll be messages on your socials and whatever. But when you, I don't know, just you do, do this podcast. I guarantee doing this podcast now, I'll be in a shop one day and a woman's going to walk up and say, listen, this thing, and she'll tell me her story or she'll say whatever. I just know that's kind of the way it goes. So I don't know what that is, but it's like, it's just one thing with a lot of lads in particular is they feel that they're letting people down when they get sick. And just the way we communicate, there's something to it. Like, men are shoulder-to-shoulder communicators, generally speaking, not always, obviously, and women are better face-to-face.
Mm.
And for me, part of the work I've had to do coming out is to keep my male relationships open and working. I realise I'm not going to do that by just being friends. I have to have a motorbike club or a scooter club or an activity. I have to have these things or I will lose touch with my friends, my male friends. I will lose touch with them.
Yeah.
I just know. It takes a different effort and an outside focus to bring us together. We have to go to a football match. We have to do, I don't know why it's like that with lads, but it's fucking like that, you know. We need something to bring us together. Whereas my female friends, if they haven't heard from me for a few days, they ring and go, what's wrong with you? Like, where are you? What's going on?
Yeah.
You know, let's go for coffee. And there seems to be a difference in communication there. So, and those are the places where lads will start talking to each other.
Yeah.
You know, if we are, and maybe not face to face as well, that's another thing I've noticed. Like, we'll go and we'll do these clubs, we'll do these spins. I'll tell them about my thing and they'll say nothing at all. But then they'll go home, or 2 days later, they'll might call up to the house, or they'll send a message and go, actually, do you know something? I'm actually in a bit of shit here. And then we can work on it.
I've heard that many times. It's really interesting. Even there was a parenting expert that was talking about, if you have a teenage, you know, kid, particularly a son, if you want him to open up, get in the car, get him to sit beside you, drive, just shoot the breeze, because he'll sitting beside you, he's not looking at you, you're not looking at him, and he might actually open up. So it must be back to that physical thing of maybe. This face-to-face is quite intense at times. It can be quite intimate to be sitting right in front of someone talking.
It's also the feeling, though, that you're not doing anything. That was a thing for me.
Oh, right, yeah.
That was a thing for me. We're not doing anything. Yeah. This is not work. When people refer to psychotherapy as work or talking as work, or it doesn't feel like work. It feels like we're all wasting our time. That's what it felt like to me. Mm. It's like, I'm not working on anything. We're sitting around talking shit. Mm. We're getting nothing done.
Okay, yeah.
Whereas, you know, getting out and about with fellas and trying to get something done, the just a simple act of trying to achieve something, like even if it's just getting to a game or getting a bike ready or going for a walk or whatever it is, there was something that felt that
you were achieving
something. And then there was an environment in where if we're talking, it felt like we're getting something done. But when going to therapy, like I've done loads of therapy, it always felt like a waste of time for me because I just didn't see it as work. I felt like, you know, I would go in to therapy, sit down, do an hour, and then not think about it at all for the whole week. Mm. And then that day go, oh, I can't believe it's going to the fucking Egypt again. That's what I felt. This fucking Egypt's gone to fucking 70 quid for this shit now again. That's how I saw it.
Yeah.
It didn't feel like work. It felt like a complete waste of time and money. And it was only like, because I had to find a new way of doing things. Now I know how to do it, but it takes experience.
And I've heard you talk about that for you, like the talk therapy stuff, it's not that it didn't have a benefit, but for you, it was, you know, it definitely wasn't top of the list in terms of the beneficial stuff.
No, but you have to find your mix.
Yeah.
You have to do it. Yeah, I tried everything now. That's the deal. I tried everything now.
Yeah.
Now I've tried mindfulness and I tried sound meditation, which just gave me the giggles. So it works for some people. It doesn't do anything for me.
Like the bowls.
Yeah, the bowl. She put a bowl in my chest and started banging it. And I was like, this is, I can't take this seriously. I can't do it. And like, you know, and people were, and we were getting a lot out of it. And there was an old lad next to me just going, and I could hear him grunting. I just couldn't do it. I couldn't. I wasn't able to focus on it. But it works for some. But if you don't try everything, you'll never find the mix. No one thing is going to get you out of the hole. It just won't.
Yeah.
And for me, meds is my number one that works for me. And then after that, it's honestly, for my mental health, it's that societal thing with staying in touch with men through clubs. That's how I do it. Staying busy and not shutting my mouth about things. And just, you know, I have my ways of doing things, but they're not going to be the same as anyone else's. That's why it takes so long to get better. It takes, you know, you have to give everything a go, right? Mm. Everything that's evidence-based, there's a lot of shite out there as well, but everything that has some evidence to it. And all these things do. Like, I think, you know, when people say swimming is great for your mental health, sea swimmers and all, and everyone's slagging the arse off sea swimmers for a while. I mean, does the sea make you feel better? I don't know. But does getting together with people in a group, having a focus every week, giving yourself a mission within the week that's not work, that you're focused on something completely different, having that, so does that make you feel better? Undoubtedly.
Yeah.
Does it matter what it is? Probably not, in my mind. But having those things, yeah, of course they do.
Yeah.
That's, you know, that's life in action.
Yeah, yeah. And discovering what it is that you genuinely get something good out of.
It's really important to have these things as well, because if you get sick and you don't enjoy them anymore, that's a telltale sign you need a bit of help as well.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
A lot of lads come up to me now and say, how did you know when to go to the doctor? And the answer is, if you've just asked me that question now,
right,
today is the day.
Yeah.
Today. It's like, when do you know you're sick enough? Now is, you don't have to be sick to go to the doctor. This is fucking lads all over. You save up your problems. Bad back, bad elbow, bad heart, bad lung. Okay, now I'll go to the doctor. I've four things. I'll get value for my money. You know, now I'll go. But it's 60 quid or I don't know. It's expensive. It's not cheap. But go now. Just go now. Yeah. Before you feel bad. He might say, there's nothing to worry about. Come back in a month's time. He might say, take some Xanax. You're just having a bad week. He might put you on some SSRIs for a little while. You don't know. But just stay active on looking after yourself. Just now. Today is the day.
Fair play. I think what you're doing, PJ, as well, just simply by just talking about it now is just great, because the more you do, and, you know, I know you're one of the many people kind of moving it forward and normalizing the conversation around.
I just hope I'm putting the right information out there as well. That's why I'm worried about that, because I'm not a professional, you know.
Well, you're talking about your own experience.
Yeah, yeah. It's just, I think it's just, I know there's problems when people are asking their local comedian for advice. It shows that we have a long way to go still, you know. Yeah. But that's it, you know, and I'm not going to talk about it for very long. I'll talk about it into next year. I literally have a deadline and I'm going to do this documentary and then I'm never going to talk about it again, because I have nothing more to add.
That's kind of cool too, for yourself, that you're like, I'm going to cover it. I'm going to do it comprehensively through maybe conversations like this.
Yeah,
documentary
exactly.
Is obviously going to be a full picture of it. When is that going to be aired?
I don't know yet, but I imagine springtime next year.
Cool.
I would say if it's not springtime next year, something's gone wrong. So I would say
we're looking forward to seeing
it's springtime,
that.
Yeah.
So anyway, you get out and what's going on in your head? Are you thinking they won't have me back in radio, or do you know that you're grand?
Oh, no, at that point, sure, I'd rang me boss for every 3 weeks.
Okay.
For the entire time I was in there saying, oh, it's going to be another 3 weeks or another 3 weeks and another 3 weeks. So at that point, I was like, okay, I have a job.
Okay, cool.
And I was feeling great. I mean, great.
Yeah.
Like when I got to the end of my stay in St. Pat's, I was really enjoying myself. And everyone outside was tortured because I was still telling everyone, don't tell anyone.
Yeah.
So when you disappear off the face of the earth for 3 months,
yeah,
people are finding it hard to cover your tracks for you. But I was inside having a great time, playing bingo and winning chocolate bars and shit. You know, genuinely. I have loads of friends at that point. And like, you make quite intense friendships. You're with these people all the time. You have your own new routines in your day. I didn't want to throw it away. I didn't want to come out. At the end, when I went into the psychiatrist, I was afraid he was going to say, right, this is your week. We're going to wind you down. I was like, I don't want to go. And because I felt so good in there, I thought the world was going to kick the shit out of me again. But it went the other way. I came out and I felt fantastic. Very, very nervous now. Really nervous. Like I was scared. But healthy scared, you know, scared like you would be before a gig or before you, I don't know, like before you do a public speech that you're, you know, or whatever, that kind of scared.
Yeah.
Scared like you might be if someone said, Sheila, you're going to get an award for your podcast. Good scared.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
But still scared. And so that was in the back of my mind. But then I got out and I was feeling really, really good and I was kind of riding high and I got back to work and the shows started to feel like they were enjoyable again and little bit of security in the gig. And then I went the other way. Then I thought I was going into a manic episode. And I sort of was chatting to Elaine and she says, I don't know, you maybe just need to talk to your doctor again or whatever. So I went back to the doctor and he goes, okay, well, what's happening? And we sat down and he goes, right, you're feeling a little bit too excited with it. And he has, like, they have a checklist, you know, they go through a whole session. It's like, are you spending a lot of money? Are you taking risks you would never normally take? And it was like, no, 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 no. And he goes, well, yeah, no, you're just happy. Like, you've just forgotten what it's like. It's just been a while. Wow. He's like, there's nothing wrong with you feeling this good. Like, this is not erratic happiness or dangerous happiness. You're just in a good place, just happy.
And did it freak you out, like, the feeling of
joy? No, I thought it was very funny. I do remember thinking, I can't believe, like, I remember sitting on the bike laughing. I say, I can't believe I thought, like, I'm enjoying my life so much. I thought I was sick again.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, I was like worried about being, I was worried about being happy, you know. I couldn't believe that. That was like, what?
Yeah.
That was mad. But it was so, it was such a nice, secure feeling, you know.
Yeah.
And it makes you want to hold on to it then, you know, it becomes a valuable thing then. Yeah, and then, I mean, after that, so much has happened. I mean, in a very short time after getting out of the hospital, because even though I was feeling like that, feeling top of the world, another year went past of me lying me bollocks off about everything. You know, I still never told anyone. It was so obvious something had happened. And, I mean, if I went into hospital with a heart attack or something physical happened to me, I was missing for 3 months, and I suddenly came out, people were saying, how are you? Like, Or where were you? But I came out of this, no one said anything. Everyone just pretended I was around all the time. So that made it easy for me not to talk about.
So it wasn't until October then of 2022 that you actually, am I right in thinking, that's when the conversation with you and Jim
was
recorded and released.
I was talking to Jim and it was getting to the point where it was a little bit ridiculous. Like, everyone in the job knew something had happened. All my friends had known something was happened. People were still texting in the show saying, you know, people were texting, they were being funny about it. Like, when I think about it, I'd say, oh, I'm off, I'm doing this thing. And they were like, oh, yeah, we'll see you in another 4 months, I suppose, whatever that, you know, people who were listening to the show were saying.
Sure.
So I was like, all right, we're going to have to say something, because we're not, we didn't have to, but just felt disrespectful at this point, you know, just felt like, what are we lying for anymore, you know?
But that was also, I would imagine, another big and important step for you in your, I suppose, maybe recovery is not the right word, but that
was recovery,
stepping away from, wait a second, you know, I'm going to own this.
Yeah, but this is, no, and you couldn't have said a better word, because honestly, recovery was what I thought was finished. I thought I was getting on with everything, but I was still covering everything up. So I wasn't as far up the recovery road as I might have liked to think I was.
Right.
And then it was like, okay, next step is telling people. I didn't think about it as logically as that, but you're right. That's exactly what happened. So Jim and me said, we'll do a podcast.
Yeah.
I'll do the Late Late, and then I'll never have to talk about this shit again. Genuinely thought that was that'd be the end of it. Mm. I'll go back to Rescue Dogs, you know. The chat. Yeah. And no, what a fucking idiot. Like, I went, what a fucking idiot.
A year on, we're
like,
still
I haven't shut my stupid face. Like, now people are like, will you please shut up?
No,
my,
they're not. Like,
you know, like, yeah, shut up. Like, so we did it and did the Late Late. And I remember doing the Late Late that night, and we're sitting there with Clint and Kelly, and we went for drinks, and we were saying, that's it now. Thank God that's over. Like, you know. And then we were saying on the night, wasn't that big a deal? Like, you know, whatever. Mm. People didn't even seem to really react or whatever, you know, whatever. And then woke up the next day, and it was the front page of all the paper, like all of them. Yeah. And then the next day, and then the Sunday papers, and then it went into the week after, and I was like, what is going on here? And it sounds like an exaggeration, I know, but there was tens of thousands of messages on Insta.
I can imagine,
I mean, it was insane, the amount, and to the point that I couldn't keep up. And that was the only time Kelly got worried. Kelly was like, you have to stop now looking at that, because that's too much.
It's a lot.
And, you know, I started trying to reply to people, and then it just, she goes, just scroll and see how many are there. And then it was like, that's okay, I can't.
Yeah, it's overwhelming.
I just can't keep up. And then, I suppose that's kind of realising then, this isn't something that's, I have to talk about this. And they're going out to the local pub, and I thought they'd go, so that's where you were. And they were all just like, oh, no, yeah, we knew, so we knew that ages, I was like, why didn't you say something, for fuck's sake?
Yeah.
So it was like,
So it, the word it had got out, I suppose.
The word had got out. It wasn't like picking up a rock and seeing everything running. It was like picking up the rock and everyone going, you know, everyone saying, surprise, like we all knew. But but the reaction to it was just huge and still has been huge. It's kind of funny now. People come up and say, Jays, you've come a long way since just being... A fella said to me last week, you've come a long way since just being like a bit of a shitty comedian and all. I was there, thanks. I was there, thank you very much. I get the sentiment, but I don't know if I was hope it wasn't that shit. But I know what he meant. Like what he meant was, you know...
I know.
Your career is very different now. Your life publicly is very different.
And you could probably tell with him, his intention wasn't to like to be...
it was funny. It made me laugh. Like, I knew he wasn't. Just being a shit comedian. Like, I was like, yeah, thanks. Yeah. So, yeah, things are very different. It's a different life now. Totally different life. And then my ma died a month after that.
Yeah.
A month after that interview, my ma died. And then 3 months after that, Kelly was pregnant. I was like, what the... What is going on?
It's a lot to kind of process and take in, isn't it? So basically, right, okay. You know, you get out, you get back to your radio show. When do you meet Kelly?
I met Kelly at the Pride March. Oh, it was the first Pride March Bowles did. So that was June, something like that.
Right, okay.
June, which would have been just less than a year than I got out.
So
I think of much
no,
less,
you would have been out.
I was out
in February, was it?
February, March, April, May. Yeah, so June.
Yeah.
Yeah. And obviously, like, we just met. Like, things happened, me and Kelly happened fast. Like, you know. And obviously, me and Kelly got together quicker than I got sick, like, which is a weird thing I've not noticed until now. But so things happened fast, like, really fast. And then, And I guess after that, I mean, it was just one of those things. We didn't really think too much about it. We threw ourselves into it and just let it lead. As I still look back on it like it's kind of a blur. Like we were just having a really good time. We still are.
Yeah.
Yeah, just having a really good time.
So as you said, your mum passes away and then... So all the while, the book is still, it's this thing bubbling in the background that you were working on.
Yeah,
that initially, because it's called Madhouse, The Naked Truth About My Chaotic Childhood, Losing My Mind and Finding a Place to Call Home. So initially, I believe the book was really meant to be about, you know, the stuff that you've spoken about before and in the previous conversation we had, which is the situation you grew up in for a number of years that was really very unique, which was that you had mentally ill people living in your home as part of an experiment that was run by the Eastern Health Board at the time,
which would be like to be all HSE now. Yeah.
Yeah. So you were writing kind of about this, but what you weren't including at this point was that your parents had a problem with drink. They were both alcoholics.
Yeah. And I was leaving all that out.
So you were leaving lots out.
So I was still spoofing about mental illness within my own family, you know, or covering up.
And again, it's back to you were feeling ashamed.
Shame about it all. Yeah. Yeah. And then I realized like I'd started writing this book. I don't know, like that book was a couple of years in the making, really, you know.
So the time we spoke in summer 21, were you already kind of writing?
Yeah, sure. That had been, it was all bouncing off the play. So the play had been on and gone and everything at that point.
Sure.
So I was already writing the book at that point. Then it was only then when I started reading back on the book after my mom died and everything, I'm not telling the story fully, truly, but I'm also not telling how, like, great she was. It's still putting the stigma on alcoholism with both my parents. And, you know, they were still, I think people have an idea of alcoholics being non-functioning or whatever. And they're like, whatever. They were people who had quite a severe alcohol problem their entire lives. I killed my dad. And they were, and in my ma's case, she was still able to pull off miracles.
Yeah.
Like, I mean miracles. Like, not looking after us, looking after these six really highly dependent men from everything, cutting their hair, cutting their toenails, giving them their medication, feeding them every single day. Like you know, in the same way that a farmer never gets a day off. Like, she was looking after human beings and not able to have any time off, had to make sure that they were okay, going looking for them when they went missing and all of this while fighting and battling her own demons.
Yeah.
As was my dad, to a lesser degree, but he was, you know. I was like, that's the truth. Like, that's the true story.
Yes.
And secrets and lies. I mean, look back now. That killed my dad. And hiding and trying to cover up things. That's so obvious. Now, having been through a different illness myself, it's so obvious, you know. So I got a couple of messages that where people saying, oh, yeah, your ma died, now you're telling secrets, like, you should be ashamed of yourself. I'm like, that's not what it is. Like, it's secrets and lies have nearly wiped us all out.
Yes, right.
And I can still say that this is the truth and be really, really proud of her and what she did and everything. That's the thing. That's the point of what I'm trying to get across.
Yeah, of course.
And to once again, just try and address that stigma. Like, addicts are people that need help, same as anyone else. That's literally what it is. I know that you can't, it's a tougher thing to treat, I know. I don't know how anyone gives up on addiction or beats addiction. I just don't know. I have no idea what that takes. Thankfully, it's not a fight I've ever had.
Yeah.
But that's real. That's what actually happened. So I felt like I had to put it in. And I said it to my sister. I remember writing the first draft and giving it to my sister. And I thought, she's going to blow a fuse now when she reads this. And she came back to me and says, oh, I remember it much worse than that, was what she said. Which is fair enough. I think life was harder for her than it was for me. She was younger, so she just couldn't leave, whereas I spent so much time, and it was the 80s. You weren't expected to be a kid at home. Kids now aren't allowed out. We weren't allowed in. You know, you literally weren't allowed in. You know, get out from under my feet. But she was just that bit younger, so I think it was a little bit harder for her. A lot harder, actually.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's good to know, though, that she was cool about you writing the book.
Yeah, very much so. She was very encouraging about it. She helped write elements of it then, and she provided all the photographs for it, and we're both, like, now quite proud of it together, I think.
Yeah.
And tonight's a big night because tonight's the book award. So, like,
of course.
Yeah. Now, I'd say I have more chance of winning than I do of being the first Irish man on the moon. But just to be there, like, is kind of...
We just stop.
You know, it's nice, you know.
Like, we were just talking about the podcast awards were last night, and I didn't win, and I was up for a nomination in the wellbeing category. But the great thing was, I genuinely was grand because I told myself leading up to it and all day as I was driving to Dublin, you haven't won, and it takes the pressure off. It's a protection thing as well. If I had, it would have been, okay, wow, I'm proper, this class. But because I told myself I hadn't, then I genuinely was sitting there feeling, oh, Grant. You know, because last year I entered and I didn't make the shortlist and I was proper gutted.
Proper
affected me. I was proper down about it. I felt like a rejection because, like, this thing that I do, that I love doing, and I felt like I put in a strong submission and not to be recognised. I felt like it was kicking the teeth. So I definitely felt it last year, but genuinely I didn't last night. So I know what you're saying. Like,
did you ever see that when he opens up the envelope and comes down with me? Did you ever see that episode? No?
No, go on.
And he goes, and the winner is Jane. And he goes, you sad little woman. You ruined my night so you could win. Did you ever see that episode?
Oh, no, fantastic. I didn't.
You have all the grace and decorum of a dump truck reversing backwards with no tires. Take your money, be happy, and get the hell out of my house.
Oh, God.
Imagine.
No.
Wouldn't you love to do that?
Hilarious.
Wouldn't you love to do that? I remember Bernard O'Shea said it would be just once, how nice it would be to see someone win an award. And instead of saying, there's so many people that deserve thanks, but please, first of all, the following people are fuckers. And
I have an amazing memory of the podcast you did with Darren, The Laughs of Your Life.
Yeah.
The, you know, The Last Laugh.
Oh, the school.
You
thing.
Were bloody brilliant. That was such a.
I went off on one.
I was class. That was class. I remember saying to her, oh, Jesus, nothing's going to top the PJ episode. And when you give that answer, it's so funny. Like,
Yeah.
Because most people are a bit trying to be gracious. And
no,
you know.
No. To hell with them. It's all right to be angry about stuff. To hell with every one of them. I hated the Kip. Absolute disaster. They thought it was going to be nothing. I hope it kills them. Shitbags. Absolute shitbags. The lot of them. I have no problem with that at all. Yeah. Oh, yeah. It drives them mad. I don't know if it's true, but you know the story of your man Weatherspoon, the pub guy.
Yeah.
Apparently his pub is called Weatherspoon because his teacher was called Mr. Weatherspoon, and he says, you'll never do anything with your life. So he wanted the teacher to see his own name everywhere he went. I hope that's true. Yeah, that's apparently.
Gas.
Now I know your man that owns Weatherspoon is a complete flute anyway, but that's, you know, from one flute to another, it's kind of a good message, isn't it?
Yeah. Has all of this honesty, has all of this, like, owning whatever it is you've been through, has it been kind of liberating or like a weight being lifted?
Yeah, big time. Yeah, honestly, yeah, really, really has. I didn't think it would be, I didn't think it would give me the freedom it has. Honestly, it didn't. You know, just to be able to, I don't know. Like, just to not have to care, you know? It's so much work hiding stuff, you know? I put so much more work into hiding everything than I did trying to fix it and make it better. Like, so much more work, you know? Hiding, don't tell this, that, this, sneak off here, sneak in there, trying to wearing my helmet up to the pharmacy so in case someone had seen me ordering, you know, taking off my helmet when I got in the door and putting it on before I left and all this bullshit. So it's so liberating. It really is. And being able to talk to other people about what's going on with them, you know, I mean, it's just better. It's just so much better. It really is.
Yeah.
It just makes you wonder why you were carrying the chains around at all. But life is so much better with them gone, you know.
Yeah.
And it's safer more than anything else. You just feel a bit safer now. Do you know?
Yeah, yeah.
It's just a safer life that you can just walk out the door and people know what you may or may not be like. And that no matter what that is, it's okay.
Yeah.
You know?
That's brilliant as well, isn't it? Because I know that like a feeling of safety is
everything. Yeah.
It's everything, yeah. For all of us.
Yeah, everything. I think it's everything, yeah.
Mm.
Yeah, so it's just to feel safe in that no matter what I say, it's going to be all right.
Yeah, that's brilliant.
There's something to that, you know.
There really is.
That's a big thing. I guess that's kind of the message, isn't it, really, I suppose. Like, I can't really tell people what to do, but, like, no matter what you say, you're safe. You are, like, I know you think the world's going to end when you open your mouth, but it won't, you know.
Yeah.
The only thing I can compare it to is going on stage the first time. The first ever gig and getting up and being absolutely shit. And to me, that was my biggest nightmare. What happens if you're shit? And what happened was the next guy got up and he was grand and everyone forgot about me, which is fine.
Yeah.
You know, it's fine.
Yeah.
So it's fine. Nothing happens. The world doesn't end. Like, in fact, kind of nothing happens. You just come back better the next gig. And this is the same, you know, you just get better at articulating yourself and people really don't care. They just want you to be well.
Yeah. Yeah. So you guys have your relationship, but also what I heard not so long ago is that you are polyamorous, which I found really interesting because it's not something you hear a lot about in kind of the mainstream conversation.
Yeah, there isn't a lot out there. There is a lot out there, but people don't talk about that either. So I guess for me, it's kind of, my own relationship, like I kind of feel that I never had a family, if you know what I mean. So I have, you know, never had blood family until now. This is the first time ever. When the kids were born, that was it.
Yeah, because you were adopted. For those who, again, I know people know your story.
Oh, yeah, sorry.
But
yeah,
just in case, right?
Yeah.
So you were adopted, you started life, you were born in Bessborough. Mother and baby home, and there was fostering for a period.
That I just found out more about.
That's right. So you didn't know for ages, and then you only found out recently.
I found it just recently, only a few weeks ago or a couple of months ago, mate. Now, actually, yeah.
Has that helped fill in the gaps a bit, or is it odd?
Yeah, I know where I was, yeah.
Right.
I thought it was just one foster home in Finglas, but it actually turns out it was three different ones. I was in Temple Hill for a little while, and I had two other foster parents. One I was with, but she wants to go on holidays. And then I was with another one. And then I was eventually adopted fully. So I've only just seen all that. And seen all those
That's another layer probably to be able to look at.
But gas, the address I was in and everything. That was lost for years and years. I've only just discovered that. So it doesn't really make me feel differently about it. It's just unusual to see it in print, you know. I'll go up and have a look outside the house one of the days.
But
in my view, I never had family as in that way. So I have a very different way of what a family means to me. It just doesn't mean the same thing. And I think I pretended a lot when people says, people had aspirations for, you know, kind of recreating their own families. I mean, I never had that. So I think I attach differently in a way, you know. And I really do believe that you can, like, love people. You can love multiple people. I do. I just really do believe it, you know. And maybe not romantically. I think, like, polyamorous people are no different to monogamous people. Sex after marriage is probably a rarity. You know, people always talk about premarital sex. That's the only sex. There's no postmarital sex, is there? is that a thing? Is that a thing? I don't know. Everyone I talk to says it's not. I think you can have formed different relationships that aren't maybe relationships, as in, you know, it's just you and me, or they're not just friendships, or I think you can have chosen family. I think I have people in my life that I don't really see them as friends. I've never been physical with them. I never will, but they feel like family to me.
Yeah.
I think relationship escalators to me are very dangerous in my head. I think, you know, the fact that we get into relationships and you say, right, we'll get married, we'll have kids, or we'll move in together, and then we'll die. And at any point, if that's comfortable, you can't take a step backwards. That to me is like, that's what I've done. I've ruined really good relationships because I thought you can't take one step back. And I think you can now. You know, I don't see why you have to destroy a whole relationship because one of those things didn't feel right. Why not step back, you know?
Yeah, take a breather.
Just take a step back. Like, we're doing great until we live together. Let's just not live together. But let's please be in our lives exactly up to that point.
Yeah.
Why do we have to detonate everything? I feel that. I really do feel that.
Is Kelly polyamorous as well?
Yeah.
Okay, so this is a shared philosophy, way of living. So, I mean, that makes sense because I suppose if one of you was and the other wasn't, that probably would cause issues.
Well, that's just cheating, isn't it? That's just like, I mean, because everybody has their boundaries. I mean, monogamous people are monogamous people and that has to be respected. Like, that's what it is. But like polyamory sort of says, you know, in the same way that I love both my kids, I don't think you have to love one more than the other. I see relationships kind of the same way. And I also can't handle the responsibility of somebody looking to me as being the only person in the world that can fulfill their needs. I can't handle that. I don't want to handle that, to be honest. I want people to sort of be able to look at me and say, you know,
so the pressure of that feels too much
for me. I want people to be able to say, like, if you know, I'm never going to leave you, but if I ever feel like I need something else, that I can have the freedom to explore, absolutely knock yourself out. No problem.
See, I'm really interested because I'm not. I'm monogamous. So I have a partner.
As most people are.
Yeah. So I don't see myself being linked romantically, sexually with another human because I feel fulfilled and committed. That's my stance, right? But I'm also extremely open-minded and fascinated by how differently people live lives. And I think it's really great that you're talking about something, again, normalizing something that is a reality for a lot of people, probably a lot more than we realize, because it's not something that is necessarily spoken about publicly. Is it a philosophy that you live by for many years, or is it a recent enough thing?
No, I'd say it's been in my head for years and years and years, but again, I was afraid to say it. Again, it's just, this is all part of I refuse to be ashamed of myself anymore.
Cool.
This is all part of that. I just refuse to feel shame for myself
being
anymore.
Yourself.
Yeah. And again, it's not like a sex thing at all, not by any means. In fact, I think if I have,
because a lot of people would make that jump, right?
Yeah,
polyamory is like you're
not,
you know, excuse my language, but you're riding all around you.
Yeah,
you know what
no, I mean my God,
I'm just thinking twins. they're 3 months.
I wasn't riding all around me when I was single.
But like you've 3 month old babies, plural, and a partner, and I know that if I'm thinking that people might be, how'd you get the time?
But that's it. There's nobody else at the moment.
Okay, so it is just Kelly at the moment.
It is what it is. And that's not nothing. I don't see that changing anytime soon. I also don't know if I'll ever have another sexual relationship with anyone. I don't know. What I will have is relationships with people that are very intimate and very close. And,
okay. But is that not just friendship then?
Well, is it?
Yeah.
Do you have any male friends you could stay in their house?
I could, but I wouldn't probably.
Yeah, so I think that's where, for me, is that's a boundary I wouldn't.
Oh,
have.
Interesting. Right. So you're.
That's what I mean when I talk about it. Like, I'm not talking, like, I honestly think I dissociate the sexual thing from it at all. Like, you know, there's intimacy boundaries that are different. So.
So for you, it's not sexual?
No, not really. No. It's so more than having the ability to have a. You know, to have intimate relationships with someone that you don't have to explain to anyone else, that are very different. And there's a lot of people who are polyamorous who are completely demisexual. They have no interest in sex at all.
Right. And so do we jump to an uneducated assumption?
I think
then?
So, yeah. I think people just associate it with sex, and it really...
It's not about that.
No more than any other relationship. It really isn't.
Yeah, okay.
People have been married for 60 years and have never gone... They've stopped having sex with each other 30 years ago. They're still in a very, they're still married couple. They're a couple.
Right. Yeah.
The sex thing doesn't dictate that. I don't think it does. I really don't think it does.
Yeah, yeah.
And polyamorous people are just people in relationships in the same way.
Mm.
You don't ever have to have sex with someone, but you can stay over in their house. You can hang out with them to a big degree. You can make them a huge part of your life. They become part of your family in a way that friends can't be.
I suppose just from, so if I was to be perfectly honest, I think my self-esteem or my feelings of self-worth would probably struggle with if my partner had a very intimate relationship, non-sexual relationship with a woman. I would probably feel like, you know, why is that not with me?
Exactly, yeah.
So I think I would probably feel like an element of, I suppose, for want of a better word, cheating.
Yeah, exactly. And but that's cheating to, if that's your deal. That is cheating.
Right.
That would never be cheating for me.
Okay, yeah, I get you.
Kelly's free. You know the way people have work wives and work husbands?
Yeah, yeah,
and that's all it is.
Yeah.
That's never going to be a problem for me.
Yeah.
Ever.
Yeah. Now, of course, my partner has female friends and I have male friends, but I suppose...
Yeah, but like if he went on holidays with someone...
Yeah, probably wouldn't
if
be great about that.
If he went on holidays with the woman he works with...
Well, you see, we can't even bloody do a night away. We haven't...
You know.
See, the thing is, PJ, we haven't even done a night away from... Our little one is two, right? We haven't done one night away from her yet. I mean, that's mental, right? But like,
it's not really. But like,
how would you get the bloody time? How'd you get the time?
We barely
have a time for each other.
Well, this is kind of funny. A lot of polyamorous people say they just live by Google Calendar. You know, you have to love a schedule. you gotta love a schedule. People I know who are like, you know, seeing more than one person are like, you know, sometimes everybody's just a pain in the arse, you know. Everybody is just a pain in the arse, you know. So I think...
So do you find certain relationships you get a certain, okay, this person fulfills this part, this need I have, or I give this to them and, you know, I then get something else from this other connection
like,
that I have.
Some people feel like that. I'm not that sort of... I don't really feel like that. I just like being around someone.
Do you know what it is? I'm just curious.
Some people
do.
I've one person in my life who's like, they're just a friend of mine, but that's very much their thing. They say they think they feel they get a lot of security and feedback and everything from this one person, and then there's someone else in their life that they think is more exciting, and they'd never live with them, but they get this different side of life from that person, and they're very much in love with these people, and that's their thing.
Yeah,
that's not my thing.
Yes, you know, sure.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's weird for me to equate, you know, say, oh, I'm going to get a fun person, a boring person, a reliable person, a DIY person. Yeah. You know, I can't. Knock yourself out, but that's not for me. I just want to be around people that I really love. I don't really care why that is.
Yeah.
You know, that's all. So we'll see.
And you can love more than one person.
I really believe I can.
Yeah.
I really believe people can. Some people can. I know it's not for everyone. It's definitely not for everyone. Jesus, people go mad. But yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. That's my take on it. Yeah.
It's great. Love it. And thank you, because I'm learning more and more and more.
There's books on these too. There's like books on it. And the thing is, there's so many different types of it. It's not like... I think one of the perceptions that people have is that, you know, all polyamorous relationships are like, it's people get together and then they open up their relationship. That's not what polyamory is either. That's an open relationship, which is a different thing. There's kitchen table polyamory where people all have the exact same standards. There's like non-hierarchical polyamory where people are all, you know, where there's no real sort of rules and everyone is equal in a different way. There's like hierarchical polyamory where there's like you have a primary partner and then you have secondary partners or whatever. There's so many, there is no such thing as, you know, one way.
One size fits all.
It really is a way of it's just literally every single... You know, it's like there's just sort of saying, I don't really know what my rules are, but I'm open to, you know, whatever.
Is that what you that's what you identify with? That it's kind of, there's no rules. It's kind of,
what I mean is like, I don't think I tick any of those particular boxes. I don't know what I am.
Yeah.
I don't know what I am. I don't know. I hope I never find out. You know, if things never, ever change from where they are now, I'll be very, very happy. So.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
And okay, so busy at the moment, book awards tonight, then heading over to Boston for Christmas, switching off the phone, chilling out, and then not as manic into 2024. And then you're going to park these conversations and all the rest because you feel like, okay, I've kind of done it.
Yeah, done then. Yeah, yeah. I have to get on with my life. You know, at some point, yeah, you just have to get on with your life and shut up.
Well, I don't know about that, but I mean...
No, some point, you know, have to. At some point, it just can't, you can't just, you know, I don't want to be one of, a person who identifies with, you know, one particular time in their life and decides that I'm the guy who was depressed. Now, I don't want to be that person either. You know?
I appreciate that. Yeah. You know, I had cancer 12 years ago and it's not something that I bang on about all the time because I
had your time, right?
I did. I did. Yeah. Oh, I did. Yeah, I went on the late talking about it. Yeah. You know, I've done my interviews and it's obviously come up in conversation here, but I also don't want to be defined by, you know, Sheila Shoiga, survivor of cancer. Do you know
what I mean?
Exactly, yeah. Because we are more than what we've experienced.
Yeah. It's a snapshot in time, really.
But I suppose these experiences, and we're lucky that we're here to tell the tale, and I feel very fortunate that, you know, like you, in a different way, mine was a physical thing, but I got the help that I needed. I had the operations, had the treatment, and I'm healthy and well. And we can talk out the other side. As I say, like, it's, you know, speak from the scar, not the wound. And I suppose you're in that position now where you've come through the darkest of times, so you're able to reflect on what you've been through. But anyway, book awards tonight.
Yeah.
Heading over to the States. Next time we talk, this could be the last time we have this level of conversation, but hopefully we might talk again in a different way. Who knows?
It's the nicest way anyone's ever said about I'm sick of your shit.
No, I love you know I love talking to you. I'll be honest, PJ.
I'm going to use that from now. I'm definitely going to say that to someone. This might be the last time we have this level of conversation. Can't wait to say that to a therapist. What a great way to break up with a therapist. Isn't it? Yeah. I think this might be the last time we ever have this level of conversation. I'm going to wish you well and I'm going to get out of here now. So, yeah.
Hey, I'm here for this conversation anytime you want, but you saying that you're parking it, I'm feeling it could be the last time. But I've loved it because, I mean, that chat that we had like 2.5 years ago really had a profound impact on not just me, but the people who listened. I know, as you said, you got the feedback, but you were just, as you always are, even though at that time you were still keeping a lot back, I felt you were being really honest. But there was obviously a lot more that I didn't
know. To a degree, I was getting there. I was learning.
Yeah, you were on the way.
I was learning, yeah.
But yeah, the book is Madhouse, The Naked Truth About My Chaotic Childhood, Losing My Mind and Finding a Place to Call Home. Brilliant, brilliant book. Best of luck tonight. Thanks for enlightening me on the world of polyamory, learning all about it. Best luck with the smallies. Milo does sound like he is a busy little lad.
My God, yeah. My God, yeah.
It's great. Message
now. What time is it over there now? You'll be at it. Yeah.
Oh, it's lovely. So enjoy the madness. It's full on, but brilliant. And so great to see you.
Thank you. Thanks so much, Sheila.
If you enjoyed this episode of PJ, please spread the word. You can let your family and friends know about it. You can pop it up on your social media accounts. And of course, you can support what I do in all the usual ways by clicking follow, giving a rating, or leaving a quick comment. Thank you so much for listening to Ready to Be Real.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High-quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.